As you know, I wanted to talk about Israeli settlements and international law. You had a piece, and you're, of course, a PhD who studies this area. Am I correct?
Yes, I'm a historian. My area is the modern Middle East, and I have written in this area, as you say.
And when talking about international law and the settlements in the West Bank, there are certain sources of international law that people point to. For example, one thing that you mentioned in your article is this Fourth Geneva Convention in Article 49.
Yes, that's correct.
And, of course, this prohibits individual or mass forcible transfers, as well as deportations of protected persons from occupied territory to the territory of the occupying power. And it also ordains that, as you say, the occupying power shall not deport or transfer parts of its own civilian population into the territory it occupies. So, as we're, Professor Gavison, in her article, kind of relies on Article 49 and says, Article 49 is proof that the settlements are illegal under international law because Israel is transferring its own population into the territory it occupies. So, what's wrong with that argument?
Well, look, the argument is an absurd one. Let's start perhaps with the very statute you mentioned. You refer to Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Its language was quite precise, and of course we also know its historical importance. It was written 4 years after the conclusion of the Second World War, and the aim of it was to see that was to codify in international law that the kind of Nazi-like deportations and massacres of civilians that happened under the Third Reich not be repeated. This was the war crime. This was the new legal norm. Make it very, very clear that this shouldn't happen. To which end the Article 49 called for a complete and absolute prohibition on individual or mass forcible transfers, as well as deportations of protected persons. Protected persons is legal language for essentially civilians. From occupied territory to territory of the occupying power, or to any other country, and also, by the same token, to ensure that no power commits the war crime of taking a group of people within its population and throwing them out of the country into another piece of territory that is occupied through an aggressive war. So I simply pointed out the obvious. None of this is actually relevant to Israel for a number of reasons. Firstly, there's a legal reason. That is that Article 49... applies only to high contracting parties. And if you speak to any international lawyer, they'll tell you what that means. A high contracting party is a sovereign power who has acceded to the various treaties, including the Geneva Conventions. It also therefore relates to territories that have been occupied in war, but from one sovereign power by another. This of course doesn't apply, because in the case of both the Gaza and the West Bank, Israel captured both of these territories from illegal occupiers, Egypt and Jordan respectively. Both of them had occupied those territories in the 1948-1949 war. They had no legal warrant to do so, but the territories lay outside the recognized borders of the states concerned, Egypt and Jordan. Jordan actually went so far as to annex the West Bank, but its annexation was illegal, was not recognized widely. It was recognized, in fact, only by two powers, Britain, who was its patron and paymaster at the time, and Pakistan. No other Muslim state, let alone any other state, recognized that annexation. So when Israel came into possession via a war of self-defense in 1967, it was coming into possession not of sovereign territory belonging to another country, it was coming into possession of territory that was unallocated under international law. So ab initio, to use another piece of legalism, Article 49 doesn't apply. But there's also a more commonsensical reason why it doesn't apply. And that is simply, if you look at the language that I quoted earlier about individual mass forcible transfers being prohibited, about deportations of protected persons being prohibited, of moving people in and out of territory that has been occupied. Let's make it very, very simple. Palestinians are not being deported or forced to be transferred from the West Bank to another territory. And Jews are not being deported or transferred from Israel to the West Bank. They're moving there freely of their own will. So we have here, I think, decisive legal and commonsensical objections to the whole idea that Article 49 could apply. Now, Professor Gavinson, in her article, to which my piece in the Jerusalem Post was a response, suggested not a lack of awareness about this. She proposed a new argument, saying essentially that the law had changed. The basis of this was the solid. She says the International Criminal Court, the ICC, which, as we know, came into being as a result of the 1998 Rome Treaty, set out a whole raft of legislation that was meant to apply in terms of international law, one of which, also very similar in wording to Article 49 of the Convention, spoke about outlawing the transfer of populations as a war crime. Now, she says that it had the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in mind, and thus the West Bank in mind when it was choosing the wording of its definition. And that this is the beginning of what she calls a maturation of a long process. Well, there's no maturation, there isn't a process. You have here, if we're to believe her, by the way, that this was in fact on the minds of the jurists concerned, that because they had something in mind, this somehow changes the definition of Article 49 or creates a new emergent legal norm, which would be a whole problem in itself, a peremptory legal norm, something like a war crime, something that's meant to be so important, so accepted in international law that from which there can be no derogation. No one can come along and say, I don't agree, I don't accede to this. That's a peremptory legal norm. Well, you can't arbitrarily redefine such a thing by this kind of procedure, because it goes against the whole grain of international law, which is the consensual nature of states. Sovereign states have to consent to law, and it becomes practice. And because it becomes the practice between states, it becomes to be regarded as international law. Here you have a definition that, according to Professor Gavinson, has been chosen specifically in regard to one conflict, the Israeli and Palestinian one, and has effectively changed the meaning of Article 49 so that something that we understood to be very, very commonsensical, that you're not allowed to murder civilians, you're not allowed to put them to forced labor, you're not allowed to deport them, suddenly means you actually can't move of your own free will and build a house in the West Bank if you happen to be an Israeli Jew. That's what this emergent legal norm that she's outlining would actually mean.
Let me remind our listeners that this is the Logic Consortium Radio, and we're speaking with Dr. Daniel Mandel about the legality of the Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And we're going and reviewing different provisions of law and seeing what the doctor has to say about them and their applicability to this current situation. So we just discussed Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. And so you're basically saying that it does not apply right now because the area, Israel is not an occupying power in that area.
Well, by occupying power, we're talking now in terms of legal definition. Israel is not an occupying power of the territory concerned, because to be an occupying power, you must be occupying territory belonging to another sovereign state. The West Bank, Gaza Strip, are territories that are unallocated by international law. What I mean by that is that the entire area of the British Mandate of Palestine, and indeed beyond, was earmarked by the League of Nations all the way back in 1920 at San Remo as territory for close Jewish settlement of land in recognition of the idea that Jews should be able to reconstruct a national home in their biblical and historic homeland. Now, that understanding, that which was, by the way, the basis of the British mandate, has never been superseded by any subsequent binding legal agreement. There was, of course, as your listeners would probably know, a 1947 United Nations partition plan by which the territory of the British mandate was to be divided into two states, a Jewish state and an Arab state. Now, had both sides accepted that disposition, outlined by the United Nations, there would have been a new legal reality in the region. But as we know, the Arab party has rejected it. So there was no agreement, and a General Assembly resolution, which is what the partition resolution was, has no legal force of its own. So the idea that Jews may not live in the West Bank or in Gaza is an entirely propagandist one. Jewish residential rights in these territories have never been abrogated since 1920, not by any of the legal agreements that have actually occurred. And when Israel came to possession of the territories in 1967, during the Six-Day War, it became possible for Jewish civilians, citizens of Israel, to actually build homes there and to build develop communities. This is, in fact, what's happened.
Before moving on to the League of Nations mandate in the San Remo Conference, I wanted to move from the Geneva Convention to the UN Security Council resolutions, and specifically Resolution 242, which calls for withdrawal of Israel armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. How does that provision interface with our conclusions right now?
Well, it doesn't alter the legal reality I've mentioned. 242 calls for two things. It was the resolution, by the way, passed by the Security Council of the United Nations, which makes it a binding resolution, unlike the partition resolution 1947, which was a General Assembly resolution, and therefore non-binding. The 242 resolution was passed in the wake of the Six-Day War, and it mandated two things, that there should be recognition of all states, including Israel, to exist within secure and recognized boundaries. And it mandated that Israel should withdraw from territories occupied in recent conflict. Now, the all-important word missing in here was the definite article, the. It didn't call it for Israel to withdraw immediately. It did not call for Israel to withdraw completely, and it did not call upon Israel to withdraw unconditionally. So, for example, people sometimes like to compare it with the UN resolution of 1990 calling upon Saddam Hussein's Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait. That was a Chapter 7 resolution, which can be enforced militarily. That called for Iraq's immediate, complete, and unconditional withdrawal from Kuwait. This is nothing like it in 67. The reason for that, Israel was widely understood and perceived to be a defending power, not the aggressor. The Arab states that had declared war on it, that had imposed a blockade on Israeli shipping to the southern port of Eilat, had committed an act of aggression, had insisted on the war. They had thrown out the UN inspectors and the garrison in Sinai and militarized a formerly demilitarized zone. They'd decided upon war. War had broken out. The Israelis had won it resoundingly and come into possession of territories in the process. Not being the aggressor, it was left, as it were, to the parties themselves to decide what their future borders would be. So, in other words, 242 does not, how should we put it, it neither compels Israel to withdraw completely from the territories, nor does it preclude that possibility. It's left to the agreement between the parties. Remember, it calls for a recognition of the states and Israel to withdraw to secure and recognized boundaries. Now, clearly, that's the crux of 242, because without boundaries that are recognized and secure, there can, by definition, be no Israeli withdrawal. It can only happen under those circumstances. So, in other words, the borders were to be the subject of negotiation. It was expected in the course of this that Israel would withdraw, but the extent and timing of that withdrawal, that was entirely a matter for an agreement to be reached by the parties themselves, an agreement which has not been forthcoming to this day.
So they lacked that key article in front of the word territories, you're saying?
Well, they lacked. It was a subject of the considerable debate at the time. The Americans and the British and the British played a very major role in drafting this resolution. They were very, very clear on this point about the omission of the definite article was deliberate, and it was precisely because they wanted to be clear that in terms of withdrawal, Israel's hands were not tied to a full withdrawal.
Moving on to 1980, before we delve into the British mandate in the League of Nations, moving on to 1980, Security Council Resolution 476 which apparently reaffirmed the overriding necessity to end the prolonged occupation of Arab territories occupied by Israel since 1967, including Jerusalem. Does this play into our analysis?
Not in any important way. The first thing is the resolution is something of an anomaly. It passed with the acquiescence of the Carter administration, a move which the administration later said that it regretted. In other words, it was a mistake. Nonetheless, the important thing about that resolution is that it does not in any way supersede 242. Everyone has agreed on this, and 242, by the way, has been reiterated a number of times. It isn't possible, actually, to speak of an Israeli-Palestinian negotiation format or an Arab-Israeli peace process without reference to 242. It was specifically reiterated in 1973 by Resolution 338. 338 is basically 242. There's no, without addition or diminution, it's exactly the same resolution, it's reaffirmation. And the Oslo process was also based explicitly on 242. That is the operative resolution for Arab-Israeli peacemaking. Absence an agreement between the parties to conclude a peace agreement on any other basis, and it remains as it is, the definitive resolution on the subject.
So, one of the key arguments that I've heard from those arguing that the settlements are legal is the League of Nations mandate system from after World War I, where the British were in fact given the mandate to create a home for the Jewish people in what is now Israel and Palestine plus Transjordan, but then plus the Kingdom of Jordan, but then it just became Israel and Palestine. How is this important in when discussing this debate whether the settlements are legal or not? How is the League of Nations mandate system important?
Well, look, the modern legal basis, jurisprudence for the whole subject stems from the League of Nations. Because, as you would recall, the First World War ended with the destruction and the dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire, which had been the previous sovereign power in the area. It was for the Allies, in subsequent treaties and discussions, to redraw the map of the Middle East, and whether we liked the way they would drew it or not, and maybe in some cases we do, in some cases we don't, the Middle East was drawn newly from that point of new sovereign states from that conflict. Transjordan, as it was then known, emerged. The Kingdom of Iraq emerged under British tutelage. Syria and Lebanon emerged under French tutelage and retained their independence after the Second World War and so on. Palestine, the British mandate, which included originally Transjordan, was earmarked for Jewish settlement and for the reconstitution of a Jewish national home. The British excised Jordan from the ambit of the mandate in 1922. It was a unilateral act. There's some reasons that can be adduced as to why they did it. There was almost no Jewish settlement east of the Jordan River. This population, though very, very small, was almost entirely Arab. The British had their own overriding strategic reasons why they wanted to create a Kingdom of Jordan. It was also thought, by the way, by the British that by removing the largest chunk of Palestine from the mandate, it would satisfy Arab claims for having achieved statehood in that general area as well. Nonetheless, of course, things didn't work out that way. Palestine west of the Jordan thereafter immediately began to transfix the Palestinians themselves and the surrounding Arab world as the decades went on, particularly after 1929.
So, and its continued importance is that it's never been superseded?
There is no binding legal agreement as to the future status of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Israel and the PLO, as we know, embarked on a process of negotiations in 1993, under which the disposition of some of the territories has been decided, but only on an interim basis. There hasn't been a final peace agreement. So the territories concerned do remain unallocated under international law. There is certainly no Palestinian state, despite the statehood resolution of last year that was passed in the General Assembly. The attributes of statehood under international law include a number of factors, such as the ability to control a contiguous piece of territory, to be exercising effective authority and control in territories that are clearly defined, and so on. And if you look at the criteria, I mean, you have it today, a Palestinian Authority which has absolutely no authority or control in Gaza whatsoever. Its writ simply doesn't run there. It's controlled by a different and rival Palestinian group. In the West Bank, you have some 42% of the territories under more or less complete Palestinian authority control, but even then, there are other parts of it, areas B and C, in which authority is either shared with the Israelis or almost entirely in Israeli hands. So clearly there isn't the criterion of effective control and law being met in the current situation. Quite apart from which, as I mentioned just a moment earlier, the current disposition of the territories and the current Palestinian rule there is subject to interim agreements. We haven't got a final agreement which settles the territory. Only an agreement, I think I wrote in Jerusalem Post at the time, the West status of the West Bank hasn't really changed in all these decades. From a legal point of view, two things could change. Israel could annex these territories in their entirety, or there could be an Israeli-Palestinian signed agreement on the future disposition of these territories. Two things which have not happened.
Dr. Mendel, in the studio with me, as I mentioned, is my colleague and friend Omar Jafri, who is not coincidentally, he actually has a debate coming up on this specific issue with Professor Eugene Kantorovich in 8 days from now at Loyola Law School here in Chicago. And he'd like to try to make an argument right now.
Let's have it.
Right. So, Mr. Vandel, I think, you know, you and some of the other people like Mr. Kantorovich as well, you know, basically base a lot of your argument on the League of Nations and the mandate. And I've seen some maps thrown around where basically there's this assumption that somehow the mandate gave all of Palestine to the Jewish people as a future state. Now, you know, that map was never ever published by the British or by anyone else with any kind of authority over there. And I think the real issue over there is what the language of the mandate was. And the mandate basically is indention, because on the one hand it says that basically it's a trusteeship and they're preparing these people for self-government. So, you know, obviously the language was written in a very colonial style, but the idea was at least on the face of
it... Well, not really colonial style. A trusteeship for self-government is really the antithesis of colonialism. It's guided independence.
Right, right. But that's what they like to, you know, portray themselves at. But whatever the case was...
Well, it's more than that. I mean, there were a number of trusteeships did eventually in time emerge to self-government.
No, that's true, that's true. But that was, we're talking about as the mandate existed when there wasn't any self-determination. But what I was saying was the tension in the mandate really arises from the fact that the British or the French, you know, wanted to prepare those people as in the inhabitants of those areas for self-government. So that they could continue on in a civil society or whatever, and which is what they did in many of those other areas. But with the exception of Palestine, you know, the real problem in the mandate for that was the fact that there was language there saying that the British had agreed that the, you know, Jewish people would be allowed to have a nation in that area. However, there is no such map that came out from the British saying all of Palestine is going to become an Israeli state. So I think that assumption...
That's perfectly true.
Right? You agree with that, right?
Yeah, no, there's no question. Neither the Balfour Declaration nor the British Mandate, which was agreed on by the League of Nations that followed it, promised statehood to the Jews in all, or indeed in any part of Palestine. The language that you may have noticed, I use the language consistently that was used in the documents, a Jewish national home. That is to say, it was to be a center of Jewish residence and culture and so on, and it was to be an area to which, because of the historical, biblical connection, as well as present and future needs, Jewish people were to be encouraged to be enabled to go there as of right, not on sufferance, and to have close settlement of the land by Jews. That was one of the terms. In other words, it was the commitment of the League of Nations, which the British undertook as the guardians of Palestine, as a mandatory power that Jews were to be allowed and enabled to settle the land and build up their communities there. You're quite right about statehood, and there are reasons why this was never put into the language of the League of Nations and the Mandate, and even into the language of the Balfour Declaration. But such intention, on the other hand, was definitely clearly part of the process too. This is, you only have to consult what was said by the main participants, by the British Prime Minister David Lloyd George, by, of course, the Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour, who, after whom the declaration is named, and many other testimonials on the subject as to what was to happen. The territory was regarded as somewhat different from all the other trusteeships and mandates because it was the only one in which you had a people that was, the majority of which, was not actually living there, but was actually had been previously dispersed. That didn't apply to any of the, didn't apply to the mandate in Lebanon, didn't apply to the mandate in Syria, didn't apply even to Iraq, which emerged as a state only in 1927, the Kingdom of Iraq. It was somewhat different. It had a much more heterogeneous population other than Lebanon. Lebanon was a melting pot of various groups. Palestine was more like other Middle Eastern communities, where it was divided much more clearly on religious confessional lines.
Right.
So it was understood that it was going to need something other than just a majoritarian decision, there should be a special disposition to enable Jews to actually live and move to the country. That was, of course, precisely what the Palestinian movement under Haj Amin al-Husseini worked to prevent, especially after 1929.
Right. So then how do you square that with the subsequent statement from the Foreign Secretary of Britain, who came out and tried to explain the process and how they fought over this language, and the reason why it is ambiguous was because it was ambiguous by design, because the Italians and the French disagreed with the language that the British had promoted, which was much stronger in terms of giving Jews a nation in that area. And subsequently, when he came out and he explained, you know, what the intentions were of the British, to say nothing of anyone else, in that statement, he basically said that nothing in this, you know, in the language of the mandate gives, quote unquote, Jews a legal claim to this land. And to basically say that they essentially could have a state or a home in this territory is without justification in the language. Now, those are quotes from the British Foreign Secretary himself. So then my question becomes,
With one, I'd agree. With the other, definitely not. It certainly did confer a certain legal rights. But you're right about the issue of statehood. Statehood was left to the future.
Right, but the British themselves said there's no legal claim to this land.
You're quoting the British Foreign Secretary. You say which particular Foreign Secretary? When?
I don't think it was Balfour. I think it was the one that was after him. But basically, there's a statement, you know, describing their negotiations with the French and the Italians, and you know, the idea being that if there's
this
any ambiguity,
because the Balfour Declaration wasn't discussed with the French or the Italians.
Right. No, I was talking about the
mandate. If you're
right.
Talking about discussions about the formation of the mandate in the League of Nations, that's a different subject.
Right. That's what I was talking about. I'm talking about the mandate.
The reason the statehood was left out of the Balfour Declaration was simply that was a British cabinet discussion, and they decided to be less concrete about the subject. It had opposition from the India Secretary, Edwin Montagu.
Right. But basically, you know, if the British themselves said that they didn't have a quote-unquote legal claim to the land, then how does the League of Nations even become a relevant, you know, topic of discussion? Because it seems as if, you know, there's this assumption that somehow, you know, the League of Nations decided to give us this territory, but that's really questionable in light of what the British said themselves.
Well, I don't think it is. The League of Nations was the premier body in terms of international legal agreements in the first half of the 20th century. There was also the part of the principle of President Wilson's 14 points during the First World War and the idea of self-determination. Once again, an explosive idea. It certainly created as many problems as it solved in Europe when it was applied. But the idea was that peoples generally should be encouraged and prepared for a statehood of their own. And the British charge was to bring both peoples to a state of independence, but it also entailed special responsibilities for enabling a Jewish settlement and the development of national institutions During the British Mandate, you actually saw the British make the punch from that and try to make a very even-handed attempt in the 20s to have the governing institutions created in Palestine in which Jews and Arabs would participate proportionally. Although in a minority, the Jews were prepared to go along with this because the Zionist movement was essentially committed to the democratic process. So despite their fears of what that might mean, given the opposition to any of their aspirations by the Arab leaders, they went along with it. It was actually the Arabs who refused the idea of representative institutions, which created a very interesting situation. Unlike any of the other mandated territories in the Middle East, Palestine, under the British, remained until the very end without representative institutions of any kind. And that's because there was no agreement reached on it. It's precisely why the issue eventually found its way, after the Second World War, to the United Nations. And after great expense and investigation, they too came up with a solution, which could have been the basis of an agreement, but as I mentioned earlier, the proposed partition into two states for two peoples was rejected by the Arab side.
Dr. Mendel, before we let you go, I wanted to ask one more question about how this idea that the League of Nations has never been superseded.
Well, not the League of Nations. The League of Nations absolutely has been superseded, firstly by the UN, which is essentially a new incarnation of it.
This right to territory that...
The Limo Conference and its arrangements
right.
haven't been superseded by a subsequent legally binding agreement. That happens to be true.
What about Israel's recognition of statehood at the UN? Does that supersede... And the subsequent Security Council resolutions, do those at all supersede or conflict with this idea the British mandate?
The creation of the Israeli state, which came about pursuant to the partition plan, but not in a conformity with it, because there was a war, the boundaries changed, and so on and so forth. And they were eventually crystallized in the armistice lines of 1949. It was with those lines that Israel was admitted as a member of the United Nations. So the territory of Israel within the 1949 lines is a settled matter that has superseded the San Remo. It's now sovereign territory. It's not unallocated territory under international law. It's a sovereign territory of the State of Israel. What remains unallocated under international law, because there's never been an annexation or agreement on the territories by the parties concerned, is the state of the legal status of Gaza and the West Bank. That remains unaltered.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming, for being a guest on our show today. We really appreciate your time and your insight.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me on.
Have a great day. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.